Welcome to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio, bringing you insights and strategies to help you create a magnificent and fulfilling second half of life. Here's your host, certified professional retirement coach and best-selling author, Dr. Dorian Mincer.
I want to welcome everybody today. This is the Revolutionize Your Retirement Interview with Expert series to help you create a fulfilling second half of life. And I'm Dori Mincer. I am the founder of this webinar series and owner of Revolutionize Retirement. Without further ado, I want to introduce Jan Cullinane, who is a terrific speaker, author, and consultant, and a retirement expert. She's written three books, and they include, her most recent is The Single Woman's Guide to Retirement, and the prior one that she co-authored is called The New Retirement, The Ultimate Guide to the Rest of Your Life, and also Retire Happy. The New Retirement book was chosen as a book club selection by the Washington Post's Color of Money columnist, Michelle Singletary. Jan's been featured on TV, radio, and in many newspapers and magazines, and her clients have included Ford Motor Company, Deloitte & Touche, AARP, federal government, Smithsonian Institute, Wachovia Securities, and Wells Fargo Advisors. Jan has a bachelor's and master's degree from the University of Maryland, and she is ABD from Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. And as Jan professes, she can speak backwards fluently. Today, Jan's going to be talking about behavioral economics. How we think and how we really think are very different. Jan, before we get into my asking you and having you tell us what behavioral economics is, can you share a little of what got you interested in this area and a little about your background?
I'll be delighted to and happy to be here today, Dori. What really got me interested into this whole realm is recognizing that so many times it's the way we think about things that will either propel us to move forward and make decisions or may prevent us from doing things that could be in our best interest. So I started reading all of these, and I listed some references at the end of the little handout, books that I felt are really quite transformational. And when we're talking about revolutionizing our retirement, there are huge implications for changing the way that we approach decision making by integrating some of this stuff we'll be talking about today. And I want to be the first to say that all these things we talk about, I am guilty of all of them, but by learning more about them, I do feel I've become a better decision maker because of it in all areas of life. But it's a process,
Yeah. And I have to admit, I've heard Jan present before on this, and it's really gotten me recognized, too. I'm guilty of almost all of the things that she's mentioned. And it's really just thinking about it, and again, being conscious of some of how we make decisions, it's very liberating, I must say. It can be humbling, but also liberating. So what is behavioral economics? What's this field about?
It's a relatively new field. In fact, the Nobel Prize in Economics was awarded just in 2002 for a psychologist whose name was Daniel Kahneman about this whole area of decision making. And what it boils down to is pure economics would say we're really rational beings. We can coldly analyze the pros and cons of any decision, throw out the bad ones, figure out what's best, and pick it. But it turns out that psychologists have realized, and there are many experiments to support it, that we're not really, that we're a lot more Mr. Spock from Star Trek, and we're not like Mr. Spock from Star Trek. We're more like Homer Simpson. So I wanted, if you have your slide, I wanted up in front of you, I'm just going to go through this and take a look. If you don't have a slide, what I'm really just showing up here is an optical illusion. So if we move through this, I want you to look at these tables. And those of you that can't see it, just recognize there's just two tables, one kind of showing long and one kind of showing sideways. And I'm going to run through this. And if you were to look at these tables, you would think that the sides and the widths are different, but as we go through it, you'll see that they're the same. So again, we often can be tricked by optical illusions. And here's another picture, classic picture. If you don't have the slides in front of you, you'll see it's that classic picture. Do you see a vase or do you see two profiles? Some people see one, some will see the other, some will see both of them almost at the same time. They can switch at will. So this whole idea of behavioral economics, in summary, is do we make decision illusions like we experience optical illusions? And the answer is absolutely yes. We're a lot more like Homer Simpson thinking with our gut than we are like Mr. Spock and thinking very rationally. So that's what the whole area is about.
That's really interesting. And why do you think it's so important, and particularly for retirement? Why is it important to understand this?
As we go through all of these terms, we'll see that there are so many when it comes to retirement that are affected, such as if you're working toward retirement, your 401k. If you're planning on or thinking about moving, what are some of these terms that will affect you for decision making? If you're thinking about investing, this could make a difference. If you're thinking about going out to exercise so you can live a long, healthy life, we're going to see these impact so many areas of retirement, but again, as I said, general life decisions too will be impacted. And understanding this and recognizing it will make you a better decision maker. So as we go through some of these terms, we'll specifically talk about how do they apply to retirement.
Great. All right. So shall we start with some of the terms, or was there more that you wanted to share about this sort of decisional illusion that we have?
I think as we talk about the terms, we will see what the decisional illusions are, and it makes it a little more specific. I have a science background. I like stories and all, but I like specificity too. So I think giving specific examples is a little bit more easy to take a grasp of, to be honest.
Let's start with
the first one.
Yep. So tell us about anchoring. What is it?
All right. And an anchor, and again, these are all terms that many experiments have been done to show that how we think and how we really think are quite different. And an anchor says we choose by comparing with a reference point. And here again, okay, now let's talk about retirement. Let's say you think you should downsize. Maybe your kids are gone. If you have kids, maybe you feel that, you know what, I'm in a two-story house. I want to just be all on one level. Or you want to move to a less expensive area. You think, okay, let me think about moving. But we have an anchor in our heads of what our house should sell for, and that is considered this anchor. And when we get some offers, hopefully we get some offers, we decide, should I put my house up for sale? And we get some offers, but guess what? They're $50,000, $100,000 below our anchor. We cannot then decide to do anything because we have this anchor in our head preventing us from moving forward, which could be a good decision because maybe we could move somewhere else and we would buy another house for less too. But those people don't want to give up their house either because of this anchor in their head. An anchor is a very powerful thing. You've probably seen it if you go in and go shopping. You see a pair of jeans. Okay, they're $100, but hey, they've been marked down to $60. And you think, what a great deal. Why is it a great deal? Because you're thinking of the anchor of the $100. And now it says $60. It looks good to you. But if you went and saw those same jeans in the store and they started off at $60 and they weren't reduced at all, you might think, I'm not buying these. They're not even for sale. So that anchor can play a role in so many things, whether we're purchasing things, selling a house is a big one, and it's a very powerful kind of thing. Another example are wines in a restaurant. You go in, you look at the wine list in a restaurant, and you see these bottles of wine, $100, $80, $70. then you see, ooh, here's one for 30. That looks pretty good. Why? Because, again, we've established that anchor of that real high one, so then that lower one looks very attractive. And of course, marketers know that. They know this anchor is a powerful thing, and they use it repeatedly to lure us into to buying things. And I just have to throw in that my son went, got his master's at the University of Chicago in marketing, and he said, hey, Mom, what's the best wine you should get? The lowest price one. The next to the lowest price has the highest markup value, because that's what most people buy, because they don't want to look cheap when they're ordering from the waiter. This anchor definitely applies in retirement decision making.
That's interesting. Yeah, it also makes me realize the dilemma we have with the housing market. There's a client that, you know, that I currently have, who knew that a while ago his house was worth a certain amount of money, and then the housing market tanked, and it's coming up a little bit, but it's still not where it was. And if the anchor is the highest price, it's a setup for disappointment and disaster, because you're not going to get it.
It is, and it prevents people from making some decisions that are really in their best interest, and housing is a huge one for that. Yes. So if we run through the rest of these, those of you that can see the slides of an anchor, there's just a little example. It shows a grill that's $6,000. And the question says, is this grill expensive? Yes, we would all agree that's very expensive. But by using this idea of an anchor, oh, but look, that grill used to be $6,300. Now it's only $6,000. Maybe it's not so bad. And it's the best price, and shipping is free. And here's another anchor. They show this sort of gold-plated grill that's $12,500. So now, again, we're starting to think, doesn't look so bad anymore. Maybe I should go for that. Anchors, to summarize, we have said whether it's shopping, whether it's selling your home, travel is another one. Maybe you've always wanted to go to Bali, for example, and 2 years ago you saw a good price. And now, even though that's high up on your bucket list, you can't bring yourself to go because you can't find that price again. That is your anchor. It can work high to low. It can work low to high. Wine, we already talked about. Many times an anchor will prevent you from making a good decision, whether it's related to retirement or, again, just general decision making.
I have a good question from Elizabeth from Minneapolis, which relates to anchor, so I want to ask it now. She just wonders, how does one family member convince another to change their anchor, such as what to sell the house for?
Well, that is an excellent question, because it's hard enough to change your own thinking. And that's why I think the first step is recognizing it. I'm always pointing them out, whether I'm with my children or friends or whatever. Oh, my gosh, here's an example of an anchor. So I think education is the first one. But when it comes to selling a house, oh, my goodness, there are many battles over that, because some people are, you often hear the expression, I'm not giving my house away. Because they've got that anchor in their head, and it can become a battle. So the biggest thing is education, pointing it out. I think the idea of shopping and looking for sales, the car, you go to a car dealer, the manufacturer suggests a retail price on that sticker, no one's paying that. We all know that, so we're all used to that one, but it can be very subtle. Just as in your book, Dory, about looking for couples discussing all of these things, that is something people do really have to sit down and talk about, because in the end, of course, a house is going to be worth what people are willing to pay for it. That's the brutal truth of it all, right?
That's the
but it's a hard
line.
Lesson. It's a hard lesson. That's why I say it's a process.
Yeah. And what you say is so true. People can get stuck in their positions about things. And it's and another way to put it is they get stuck in their anchors about things, too.
They do.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Yeah. Let's move on, just because there's so many topics and we'll get more discussion. But so what is lost aversion? Loss aversion.
Okay, loss aversion. And loss aversion is a very interesting one. And I think if you think about it, all of these will make very much sense, but it's like we grow up with them all. Loss aversion says, and again, studies have shown this, that we feel twice as bad about a loss than we feel good about a similar gain. We feel twice as bad about a loss than we feel good about a similar gain. I always think of all my years of working when I had to be evaluated. I used to teach in a college. I get all these student evaluations and generally, hey, they were good. I get one that was like, Mrs. Cullinane, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, it would just crush me because I felt that as a loss. And I negated all the good stuff, all the gains, all the positive feedback, and my head drilled in on the negative. And that is loss aversion, that we feel twice as bad about a loss as we feel good about a similar gain. What are some of the applications for that? If you think about, again, selling a home. And again, a lot of these will overlap. So when we go to sell our home and we feel it's a loss because, hey, we had that anchor, we feel like it's so hard to do. We're investing in the stock market. You got some kind of a bad stock. It's bad. You're feeling the loss. But then if you sell it, you're always hoping it's going to come back because you're going to feel so bad that you lost money if you sold it, that people will often stay in way beyond the point that they should. So again, there are definite ramifications here for retirement where people will often stay in an investment because getting out of it and they've lost money, they feel that so strongly, even though they should just cut their losses and move on. And that is loss aversion.
So have there been studies at all about loss aversion?
Absolutely. There have been studies about all of these, whether it's all of these terms. And I'm going to give you a couple examples of specific studies, one that's really interesting with JAM. But over in the books that I had put on the little handout, they give study after study showing how people have responded with these sorts of things and why it's been all substantiated, yes. And again, I know we can't talk for the almost 80 million boomers, since that's a big portion of our audience, I know, and say this applies to every single one of them. But this is, in general, how people think. There's certainly exceptions. My husband, for example, he is Mr. Spock. He is very rational. But, okay, let me give you an example of a study they did with loss aversion and tell me how you feel about this. Here was the study. You picture yourself as Mrs. A or Ms. B. You are in line at a movie theater. So picture yourself, you're in line at a movie theater, and you get up and buy your ticket, and they say, hey, congratulations, you're the millionth person who has patronized our theater buying a ticket. We're giving you $100. You would feel pretty good, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Now imagine you're in line at the movie theater, and you're going to buy your ticket. And the person in front of you, they say, congratulations, you're our millionth person. We're giving you $5,000. And hey, the person behind you, which is you, actually, the person in front of you got the big amount. We're giving you $100. They posed it and said, who would you rather be? Would you rather be that person that got a moderate amount of money, $100, because you were the millionth person? Or who'd you feel better being? Or would you rather be that person who was behind the person? You still got $100. You ended up losing the big amount. And people over and over have said they would rather get less money and have been the millionth person than be behind somebody who got a whole lot, and maybe you even got a little more, but you felt that loss, that you weren't the one who got the big amount. I don't know if that made sense or not, but did it?
Yeah, no, but it's a subtle loss. It's subjective.
Subjective. And people who think more like Mr. Spock would say, hey, if I got 150 instead of 100, I'm fine with that. It's more money. Yes, that's a very objective way. But if you said, oh, if I was only the person in front of me, I feel bad that I only got $100. They got $5,000. So it's that sort of a thing.
Yeah, and it can play into that second guessing that all of us can have that gremlin inside of us. If only I had gotten there a moment before, I would have.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. We'll come back to some of these in the discussion and all too. But what is hyper choice?
Hyper hyperchoice, I also call analysis paralysis. Hyperchoice says, you know what, sometimes there are just so many choices that it's overwhelming. Do we often feel about that, again, with retirement choices? Pure economics would say, hey, you got a cold, go get some Sudafed, for example. I have nothing to do with Sudafed promoting it. It's just the picture I have of the slide. Okay, standard economics would say, hey, you have a choice, you can go get Sudafed. That's great. You have something to take care of your cold. It would also say, though, if you've got several choices, that's even better. And it would also say, pure economics, if you can see this slide, and we've all been in the store, you go in and get some sort of a cold remedy over the counter, and you see over and over just piles and multiple choices to choose from, and it can be overwhelming. So what it turns out is that standard economics says more choice is always better. But what have they really found? They really found fewer good choices ends up being better for your decision making, to narrow down your choices. And here's an example that they did. They did this in a store, like a little upscale store, and they offered people samples of jams to try. And in one experiment, they put out 24 different jams that people could actually sample and see if they liked it. And it turns out that 6 out of 10 people passing by certainly tried the jams. Here there were a whole bunch that they could choose from. But when they went to buy a jam, only 3% of all the people purchased them. Why? 24 jams is a lot of jams. They changed the experiment a little. They narrowed it down, only put out 6 jams. Not as many people came by. There wasn't as big a crowd, only 4 out of 10 people who came by sampled the jams. But 30% rather than 3% actually bought a jam. Why? Because their choices were narrowed and they could pick from it. People experience, again, loss too. Loss aversion plays into this. They think of all the choices they didn't make. Did I make a bad decision by not choosing all of those? Narrowing our decisions can be a good thing in most cases. If we can narrow our decisions, we make better decisions, and we have more satisfaction. Too many decisions, they found over and over with people, decisions become less likely, and their satisfaction with what they decided is less likely. And I often think, again, as far as what are the applications to that, relocation. Think about now if, say, people in retirement want to relocate. For so many of them, it's just too overwhelming. You can move anywhere in the entire world, right? How do you narrow down those choices? Relocation can be a big one. Most of us ended up where we are because maybe a significant other got a job there, we got a job there, we went to college there, our parents are there, that's why we're living where we are. But now suddenly, what is it, Southwest says you're now free to move about the country, that we can move anywhere we want. It suddenly becomes overwhelming. So when people always say, yeah, they want to age in place, sometimes I think of, because look at the alternative. You can pick up and move anywhere, and it's so overwhelming to try to figure out what to do. So that would be one example of hyper choice. Narrow down. So if it's relocation, I always tell people, what are your non-negotiables if you want to move somewhere? Do they have to have good medical facilities? Do they have to have a lot of airports close by? Does it have to be by the water? Does it have to have a low cost of living? Narrow down, what are the things you, or if you have a spouse or a significant other, what are those things that you have to have, and start working from there? Shopping. If you're not a big shopper, I'm not a big shopper. I could easily move that off my list, for example. But an airport, visit my children or whatever, that was pretty high on my list. So what are your non-negotiables? If you narrow your choices, you make better selections. It's easier to make a selection and you're happier about them. So that's hyper choice.
A couple of questions tied in with that. Have you found, or have studies suggested, that there's an optimal number of choices when it becomes less overwhelming and more doable for people?
Yep, they usually say about 3 to 7 If you can narrow your choices down to about 3 to 7 things from which to choose, that's about the optimal to choose from. Think of paint samples. Think of if you're going to paint, and I just went through this, and they hand you that book with all of those paint samples in it, 50 shades of gray. There really are 50 shades of gray when you look at it. It's just overwhelming. It was like, oh, just paint it the color it already is. I fell immediate victim to hyper choice. I could not narrow it down, not to mention all the finishes. Mm-hmm. But, and I work with the decorator sometimes when I was building the house I'm in, and I'd go in and I'd look at all the, say, tile. And in the end, it was, Patty, show me 4 tiles that'll look good, and I'll pick from that. I didn't even know about hyper choice then. All I knew was there was no way. Some people can do it, but not me. So it was like, show me 4 that you think would look good in the house. Then I could choose from that, and it worked very well. Mm-hmm. Same with everything else. Show me 4 or 5, and I'll pick from that, granite.
Much less overwhelming. I remember this other time when you spoke, you had used a term satisfying, which I thought that was a great term. Can you share what that is? Because I think it relates to this.
Okay, there's a term called satisficing. And
satisficing, that's what it was.
Means it's good enough. It will work. And that's why I sometimes do talks just about relocation and talk about be a satisficer rather than a maximizer. A maximizer is the person that feels they need to investigate every single certain possibility that's out there, whereas a satisficer will say, I got to have this, and the rest will be okay. Because you know what? Most people end up being happy, say, if we're looking at relocation where they live. There's some that realize they made a big mistake and they have to pick up and leave. But most end up being okay. And satisficers, ones who say, I got to have a few of these elements, and once I have that, you know what? I'm good to go. They end up being happier with their decisions than the maximizers that feel they have to look under every single rock and in every nook and cranny and try to analyze every single thing.
Excellent. We have another question that relates to this hyper choice. Mary from Newburgh says that she loses a lot of her zeal with her hyper choice spouse over analyzing what strategy can help. So she has trouble with that. And she says, what strategy can help me maintain my zeal while he's deciding?
Great question. Your zeal and your sanity, probably. It's difficult when people approach things from different ways. The hyper choice ones, understanding some of this stuff, but that gets into some of these other things too. People believe what they believe in, that it's the right way, and it's very hard to change people's opinions. We all know that, right? Whether it's politics or whatever. So I'm not going to say it's something that's easy to do, because a lot of times with hyper choice, you end up not making a decision because there's just too much analysis. So I think I would start with, and what I suggest is, okay, let's say whatever it is, if it's relocation, write down what are your 3 biggest priorities for a place that you're going to move, or you're gonna paint. What are your 3 biggest priorities? Do you want it to be light? Do you want it to be dark? And then at least you start getting it narrowed down into some areas. But again, I'm not going to lie to you. It can be a struggle if one's a satisficer, hey, this place looks good, let's put a bid on it, versus, okay, we got to look at the taxes, we got to look if we're paying homeowners dues. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, that's a good thing, and that should probably, the cost so obviously is got to be one of your big things. But it's really discussion and starting it early. I can't tell you how many talks I used to be at, and people would come up and say, we're retiring now, we're 66, and I suddenly realized that, guess what? He wants to move to the mountains, and I wanted to move to the beach all these years, and we're not planning on moving to California, so we're in a bad way to start early, which I know is what your book certainly recommends as well. These discussions have to come up and evolve when you're talking about these big decisions over long periods of time. And I think the books that I gave you and showing what the experiments did and showing people are happier, if they could be convinced of that, it can go a ways toward doing it too. But if you have 2 different kind of personalities with that sort of thing, and analysis is good, don't get me wrong, I'm a big believer in looking at pros and cons, but pushing them to making fewer making your analysis based on fewer choices rather than every single one that's out there.
Great. Ties into one other question before we move on to the next one, which, again, Elizabeth from Minneapolis just underscores that narrowing choices is so important. And she says that she's trying all the time with career clients to narrow down their career choices, but they want to keep them broad. But usually what she's found is once they narrow them down, they end up moving forward much more quickly. She mentioned that this was the first time she heard of the JAM experiment, and I know you also mentioned the paint. Do you have any other kind of real-life examples that you can share to help clients realize that narrowing choices is a good thing?
Elizabeth has certainly hit it right on the head, and if people realize that. So I think actually the JAM experiment is a good one to share with people, and the ones of telling them to go into a store, and just like those pictures on the slides of people were able to see them, and look at all of those decisions that can be thrown at you. How do you feel better? Do you feel better like looking at the movies? See, I think the movies are good because you go to a movie theater or you look and see what's playing and, okay, maybe there's 7 movies. You can generally pick one that you want to go to. You can throw them out. But let's say you're a Netflix person and you're starting to look at all of the movies that you could possibly order. It can become somewhat overwhelming. So you have to work on yourself to narrow it down. I think trying to think of some other specific studies that they have done, and the books are chock full of them, and most and those books you can get at your library or whatever. You don't have to go out and buy them to order them to see what those are. But the JAM experiment is classic one that they use. I'll try to think of some more, dredge it up from having read those books of what some other specific ones are. But the JAM experiment, I think it's simple, it's elegant, and it proves the point very readily. Fewer good choices are better than infinite choices.
Great. And just a comment that Mary, who asked the question about her spouse who was driving her a little nutty with too many choices, she said, "Thanks for your great answer. I'm limiting his choices starting today."
I think back to when my kids were little, and again, before I knew this idea of hyper choices, it would be, okay, Jeff, what would you like to drink for with your dinner, milk or water? It immediately narrowed their choices. They still had a choice, which was good, but guess what? They could choose, and so they felt good. They had some control, but they chose.
Yeah.
It's a good approach.
That's great. And Donna from Texas had a good point. She says, look at Trader Joe's. They don't have an overwhelming selection of anything, only a couple of options of each kind of food rather than what you have in more traditional supermarkets. And people tend to love that. So I think that's maybe a good marketing strategy that they have of limit the choices and people will choose one or the other or one of three.
Perfect example.
Great example. So let's go into future discounting now.
Yeah, future discounting. This is probably one of my favorites, and I'll share with you an experiment about this. Future discounting says, and we can all relate to this, right now, like, we're feeling pretty good. We're saying, okay, you know what? On Monday, I'm going to really start eating better. We can say that. Or the beginning of the month or January 1st or whatever. In the future, we will make good decisions. I'm going to start saving for retirement. But what we tend to do now is the quicker, easier thing that satisfies us immediately. So the experiment, and again, this is a classic experiment they did about future discounting. Researchers had a group of 200 participants in the study, and they said to one group, okay, we're going to send you a snack in a week, and the snack's going to be either a delicious, healthy apples, or we're going to send you some chocolate. Now, I know chocolate can be good for you and dark chocolate and the 70% cocoa and all that. Okay, but let's assume this is bad chocolate for you. And said, but in a week, we're going to send this to you. What would you like us to send you, the chocolate or the apples? Guess what? People who are making decisions about what was going to be delivered to them next week, about 75% said, send me the apples. Why? Because they could make good decisions for themselves in the future, for their future self. But when the researcher said to the people and walked in and said, okay, right now, I can give you either an apple or I can give you this chocolate. What do you want? Then 70% took the chocolate. And so future discounting says that we make good decisions for ourselves for the future, but when it's here and now, we tend to take the pleasurable or easier choice. Okay, I think we can probably all identify with a lot of that. For example, when we look at our eating habits, when we look at exercising, when we look at saving for retirement or retirement planning, how many different surveys do we have to read that people haven't started saving? Part of it is because people feel it's so complex. There's a lot of these different kinds of behavioral economic terms that feed into that. Too many choices. How am I supposed to invest? What am I supposed to invest in? All of that thing. But future discounting, should I buy these shoes now that I really like? Or should I take that $100 and put it toward my future 20 years from now? Guess what? The shoes usually win because it's future discounting. But if you recognize it and realize it, delayed gratification is almost a term that we're all familiar with, but future discounting is the behavioral economics term. So that is something, that's for example why they say one thing, you should clear out all the junk food in your house, right? Because you might be get up in the morning and say, I'm not going to eat those Fritos or whatever, but guess what? If they're there and they're beckoning to you about 4 o'clock, it's a lot easier to eat them than if you've removed them and say at 4 o'clock, oh man, I don't have any. Am I going to really get in the car and drive to the store to go get something to eat, some kind of food that I'm craving that I know isn't good for me? No. So you have to set up that's why they always talk about setting up your environment so it's easier to make good choices for you. And they've actually done this with a lot of things, for example, and we'll get to one of these later, but one is 401ks, for example. 401ks, it turned out that people were thinking that they wanted that money now, even though they know if you're working and you have a 401k, you should certainly sign up to have it. But they realize now that's why a lot of times people have to opt out of their 401ks rather than opt into them, because they found out if they left it up to people, they might say, yeah, I know it's for retirement and that'd be good, but people really wanted the money now. When they made them have to actually try to get out of it, that they were automatically enrolled, then their future self was easier for them to make a decision. They've tried to do a lot, it's called choice architecture now. They're setting up things for us to make it easier to do something for our better self. Seatbelt. You know what? My first car was a little Mustang, and I actually cut out the seatbelt in my car because it wasn't mandatory to wear it because I didn't like it. Once it became a law, though, and I had to wear it, they changed the way our environment works so we make better choices for ourselves. So there's a whole lot of that going on now of trying to set up our lives for us in a way that make it easier to make better choices for us.
That's an excellent point. Just even thinking about, people say they want to save, but they never quite can do it. But if you do an automatic deposit into your savings or into your 401k or something like that, then you're doing it. You're not letting that impulsiveness win out. Yeah. Which ties into a question. Go ahead. No, I was going to say that it ties into a question that Dick from Connecticut asked, and he said, isn't impulsiveness another aspect that needs to be considered as irrational thinking?
Yes, some people are very impulsive, and that can be a great characteristic too, because sometimes just taking the leap and doing it, say you're going to start a business, and if you're a super analyzer, you might think of all the reasons you shouldn't, and some of those reasons could be very good, but sometimes being impulsive, and that does, of course, go along with your personality as well. And that can be a big issue if you're very impulsive. But future discounting would say most of us tend to pick the easier choices, not all of us. So if you are an impulsive person, yeah, you're going to be much more likely to fall into that category than if you're very rational and thoughtful. So, yeah, you have to certainly take this personality. Are you a risk taker? There are a lot of personality traits that can come into any of these decisions as well.
Great. Let's keep moving right along then. So framing, framing is a concept that I know as a coach I use a lot, but I think it's similar but somewhat different in this behavioral economics way.
Have your slides, if you can see them, I love this picture. What this slide shows is a urinal. Okay, a urinal. And if you look at the urinal, you can see a little black spot above the drain, okay? So a picture of a urinal with a little black spot above the drain. Let me tell you what framing is. I just love this picture. I actually was in Utah, and my husband said, hey, you got to look in the men's room. Here's a great one for framing. So I said, okay, is anybody in there? Let me go in and run in and take the picture of this urinal. Okay, framing says that you can often read or say or hear something, and depending on the way it's worded, will make very different choices. This urinal here with the fly, what the heck does it have to do with it? It turns out this actually started in Amsterdam. The people cleaning the bathrooms, like in the airport, found that, oh my gosh, we had these urinals, but there's a lot of spillage. Spillage is the term they use. What can we do about the spillage? And then someone said, let's reframe what it is people are aiming for. Instead of this entire urinal, you know what that little black speck is if it was magnified? It's a fly. They put it right into the ceramic. It's a picture of a fly. It's not a real fly. It suddenly changes the frame of what you're doing. And they found that the spillage was reduced by 80% just by doing that. I love this example, but I like all that stuff. So framing means, here's another example. This is a study that they did. Financial advisors asked their clients, can you save 20% of your income every year for retirement? And the great majority said, gosh, no, I can't do that. We're living paycheck to paycheck, no way. When they asked similar groups of people, if you had to, could you live on 80% of your salary? The great majority said, yep, yeah, if I had to, I could. So you take the same sort of a thing, but depending how it's framed, it can make you think very differently. Another example would be beef. You go into a store. What are you going to be more likely to buy? Beef, if you eat beef, that says it's 80% lean, or beef that says 20% fat. The way things are framed make a huge difference. And I like people who talk about when they go to buy something, thinking about retirement, what am I going to do? Am I going to buy this? Or what if they reframe it and say, how many hours do I need to work to buy this? Or if they say, I'm planning on going to visit a friend, say, in Canada, how much of my ticket that I want to buy to go visit that person am I going to be losing by buying this item? Do I really need it? So framing is very powerful by just trying to twist the way you look at something in a new light, and by reframing it, you'll often end up making a better decision. So I think that's a very powerful one too.
That's very powerful. Elizabeth from Minneapolis asks, Jan, how did you come up with the 10 items that you've mentioned in regard to individuals' irrational decision making? She just commented that this is the most
interesting
learning.
Oh, how did I come up with these terms?
Yeah, the 10 items. Yeah.
Okay. I came up with the terms by reading all of those books that I had given you a reference on. For example, Predictably Irrational is a book. Nudge is a book by Richard Thaler, by Dan Ariely, who's written all these books. These are all the terms that are used. So it's by immersing myself. There are tons of the terms, and I knew we had a limited time. So I picked ones that I thought were something we could all identify with that had definite applications to retirement planning to make us better decision makers. They do all overlap, but it's really just ones you're going to find anywhere when you start reading about all of this behavioral economics. So I just got it from, but they're like my top ones that I like.
Great, thanks. What about status quo bias? What's that?
Yeah, status quo bias says, guess what? As a group, and again, I know there are exceptions, but Most of us, we like things, if it ain't broke, don't fix it sort of thing. Let things go the way that they are. That it turns out that we're biased to keep things the way they are. It is easier to do nothing than it is to do something in many cases, okay? Status quo bias. Here's an example I think is unbelievable. This is about my favorite example that you can have for any of these. Okay, it's about organ donation. To be an organ donor, what do you have to do here in the United States?
You have to opt in. You have to, on your driver's license, say that you want to be an organ donor.
That's right. You have to opt in, right? Okay. These people, these behavioral economists have said, let's look at what other countries do. If we look at Austria and Germany, Austria says, guess what? We're saying as a country, because we think organ donation is very important, you have to opt out of being an organ donor. Everyone is presumed to be an organ donor unless you sign papers saying you're not. Germany, because they wanted to compare countries that were very similar with people and economies and all, Germany said, it's like us, you have to opt in to do something, okay? Because they knew about the status quo bias. It's easier to do nothing than something. So if we look at Austria, where you are presumed to be an organ donor, guess what the organ donation rate is as a percent?
What
is
99%.
99%. Guess what it is in Germany, which is like us, where you have to opt in? 12%. It's huge.
That's
why?
Nice.
Because
yeah.
It's easier to do nothing than it is to do something. The status quo bias at work. This is a huge thing. A lot of people in the United States say we need to go and have people opt out of it. It has to be automatic that they're in it. But others say, no, we're all about choice and freedom and all of that. That's not going to work. So there's a big controversy about that. But I think that's such a powerful example. 401ks, which we mentioned before, all of these terms can overlap. But 401ks, they found by making people opt out of a 401k, people were not opting out. They were saving more for retirement. And in fact, at companies where you suddenly had to start opting out, some went up as much as 90%. A few people still opted out. They wanted their money. But most just said, oh, it's done. It's a done deal. They didn't bother. When you think of Medicare, if any of you have looked at this prescription drug benefits, the Part D for Medicare, again, they can be, first of all, overwhelming choices, so we have the hyper choice in there, but often people will just pick something and then it's, oh, they're just going to do it every year. They're going to keep the same benefit even though their drugs have changed. And a study from the University of Pittsburgh found that people lose about $368 or something a year by not picking out the best plan for them. Why? Status quo bias. Hey, you made your decision. It was tough enough. You're going to leave it alone. Relocation is another. Why do people say they're just going to stay in place? Yeah, some certainly want to. They have their support system and all that. But personally, I think some are just saying it because guess what? It's easier just to stay where you are than do something about it. And then look at subscriptions, cable plans, insurance, all these things. How many people might get magazines month after month, year after year, where they automatically bill you because they know about the status quo bias. And a lot of people keep getting stuff. They don't look to see, could I get better insurance rates for my car, for my home, subscriptions, all that stuff where we could be probably saving a lot of money if we understood the status quo bias, knew that it works to keep us just the status quo and not changing things.
That one's huge. I know with me and magazines and this automatic thing, at the school that my son used to go to, they're in the attempt to go green, they have these big campaigns, which I think has become national now, of opting out of these magazines because you can see them all online now. You don't need to, but it takes effort to cancel them.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, so
status quo.
Let's keep moving on here. Hedonic adaptation.
Hedonic adaptation. I love this one too. Hedonic adaptation is a good thing. Hedonic adaptation says, it can be good and bad actually, but the point is, and I think it's very comforting in a way, hedonic adaptation says if something terrible happens to us, we lose a friend, we lose a spouse, they've looked at people who have lost limbs, who have been in horrible accidents, divorced, widowed, big bad things happen to you, that after a period of adjustment, most people, again, I'm never going to say all, most people bounce back to their former level of happiness. And experiments, again, and surveys looking at people, if you don't have the slides in front of you, there's one on hedonic adaptation in divorce, where people reach this low point when they get divorced, but after several years, you can see that their happiness level, they looked at their happiness level before the divorce and after, gets back to right about the same level. That happens too with being fired. Seems like it could be catastrophic, but yet when you look at this several years out, people are really down when the firing happens, but you looked several years out and they're as happy as they were before they got fired. Widowhood, and I had the most, I was doing this talk in Ohio recently, and this woman came up to me and started crying and said, I'm glad I had actually showed the same slide about this widowhood because it showed a decrease in happiness and then after several years getting back to that same level of happiness. She said, it's very true. And she said, I never thought it would really happen. It's been several years since my spouse died. And she said, I think that just really has to be, that word has to be spread. Some people never do recover, and I will say that, but most people start to bounce back. Hedonic adaptation is a very powerful thing. It's good to know about it. It can be good. But when it can be negative is what you call the hedonic treadmill. And that means you are always trying to get that boost of happiness. So it can work the opposite way too. You get a raise, you get a promotion, you move to a new house. It's all this blast of, oh my gosh, euphoria. But then guess what? We tend to fall back to the same level. And that's why, of course, they say we should really use our money, our disposable income, to buy experiences. Because you might buy a watch, but you get used to that watch on your wrist all the time. But maybe every time you think about a vacation that you went to, you get that little boost again, over and over again. So they found that's why really you should spend your money on experiences rather than things. Hedonic adaptation, we get used to the things, but experiences, as we recreate them in our mind, give us those little positive boosts again. So I like hedonic adaptation a lot, and I find it very comforting as we get older and things happen that we can bounce back from it, and most people do.
Now that is a good thought to hold on to in terms of the resilience and the bounce back. It's so important. Confirmation bias.
Okay, and this is one, I think this is the toughest one. This is the toughest one I have working on, I have to say. Confirmation bias says we seek out information that reinforces our beliefs. We hang around people that are like us, right? We watch television. I have two little slides here. One is, do you watch MSNBC or do you watch Fox? We tend to watch things that reinforce our view of the world, and it's very difficult to change that. Warren Buffett, for example, everybody pretty much thinks he's pretty smart, but he said he knows he can be victim to confirmation bias. He doesn't want to be surrounded by yes people all the time. So he always invites people who disagrees with the way he invests into his meetings because he said it keeps him honest with that confirmation bias. Confirmation bias, I think, is really responsible for a lot of our problems, whether it's political or religious or whatever, because we just tend to stay in our same sort of realm of people. It's a tough one to move off of. The science says if you really want to try to be a little more open to things, don't go to a whole diametrically opposed position and try to read about that. It generally makes people dig more into their position. You need something that's just a little bit off from your own position. It might get you to be nudged to be a little bit more accepting of other positions. But this whole idea of confirmation bias is a big one and a tough one, but it's certainly a bias that we have in a way of thinking.
Yeah, important, and, I think, to be conscious of it, yeah.
to be conscious of it. And the overconfidence bias is another one. Overconfidence bias, also called the Lake Wobegon effect, would be saying that in Wobegon, where all the men are smart and all the women are beautiful or whatever, and all the kids are above average. Most of us tend to have some overconfidence bias, which is good. It can certainly be a good thing. It gives us the ability to feel confident enough in our decisions. But there are a couple things that can be bad in that studies have shown that our financial savvy after about the age of 53 can start declining some. Again, not for everybody, but in general. So we should be aware of that with our overconfidence bias as we plan for retirement. We might think we're more confident than we should be about our ability for retirement, and so we're not as worried about it. These other two statistics I have up here are just fun, and I think we all could relate to them. 93% of U.S. drivers think they're above average. 93% can't all be above average. And 60% of men and women think they look better than those their same age. I think a lot of us are guilty of that. And I have two slides here, if you could see. The first is of Whistler's mother. Everybody can picture Whistler's mother. She was about 65 when Whistler painted her. But with our overconfidence bias, and I'm just using a woman in this example, we might think we're looking more like Sophia Loren at 65, who is still looks like a sex goddess. So this overconfidence bias can help us, give us confidence, but it can also lead us down a wrong path if we're too overconfident with things. And my last one I'll just talk about a little bit is called the endowment effect. And what the endowment effect says, and this, again, a lot of these overlap, is that we tend to value things more than identical products that we don't own. For example, again, if we're invested in a stock, we tend to endow it with more power. We think it's better than other ones, even if they're badly performing. We think our house is worth more than a comparable one in the neighborhood because it's our house. They found people at yard sales, they often tend to overprice these items because, first of all, loss aversion, they're going to not have them anymore. But because they have owned them, they think that they're really worth more because of the endowment effect. In the end, I've just listed all of these what are called predictably irrational behaviors, this anchoring, hyper-choice, future discounting, status quo bias, loss aversion, hedonic adaptation, framing, confirmation bias, overconfidence bias, and endowment effects are all ways we can, the way we think and how we really think are a little different, but being aware of them and recognizing them in ourselves, hopefully if we have a significant other, is really the first step to becoming better decision makers.
This is so excellent, and I think in each area there could be so much more time spent of just thinking about what this means for ourselves, for clients, if we're professionals or have clients. It's really amazing to think about it all. And a number of people have commented on just how terrific this presentation has been. And again, Elizabeth from Minneapolis has asked, how did the beginning when you not talking today, but in the kind of advertisement marketing of the talk, you use the word edutaining, and this definitely was an edutaining speech. So how did you come up with that word, edutaining?
How did I come up? I don't know. I think I just combine obviously educational and entertaining. And to me, they're both. It's educational. I feel the information, but it's also very fun when you look at the experiments and it's an entertaining. It's just, you know what? I can talk backwards. I know that's what it sounds like. So I don't know. I just have a thing with words, and it's just a mishmash of them, of combining different things. Who knows? Maybe I stole it. Maybe I saw it somewhere in somebody else's presentation description. And I said, hey, this is a good word. I can't really exactly remember how it came to
me. It is a good word. And it has been a very edutaining presentation. And many people have said that it's really cool, very relevant, very well done. I just want to thank you very much. And before the final takeaway that I want you to do, I just want to remind everybody that on November 26th, we're meeting again, and Abigail Trafford is going to be with us, who's also an author, speaker, retirement expert, author of My Time, Crazy Time, and As Time Goes By. So I hope all of you, third week of the month, will sign up and be with us. And Jan, this has just been terrific. And I just wonder if, first of all, I want people to know about your books on the handout that's with this. She's mentioned four different references that she's mentioned during the talk. And before your final takeaway, do you want to just let everybody know what your website is and just mention your books again so people are aware of them?
Sure. Yeah, and I have to say, to put in a plug about my, and it's not really about me, but the book, The Single Woman's Guide to Retirement, I just found out recently, and it's published by John Wiley and Sons, and it had input from AARP as well, but it won in the 2013 Apex Award for Excellence in Publication in the ebook and book category. So although I'm taking some responsibility for it, all the people at Wiley and AARP who are involved in this book get tremendous kudos for that. So that's just recent, so I'm happy about that. My book, The New Retirement, is a little, it's been out there a little while, so I don't really try to push that one. My book is The Single Woman's Guide to Retirement. As other people have said, though, there's information about there. I always write holistic books. I like the holistic approach to everything, not just about money, not just about moving, but about working and volunteering. And one guy from a radio interview said, hey, guys, don't turn it, tune out. There's a lot of stuff in here for you, too, as well. The Single Woman's Guide to Retirement, which has AARP's endorsement on it, is the book that I'm promoting now.
And I want to thank everybody for your comments and questions, and I think I tried to integrate all of them, and there have been a number now at the end just again saying thank you so much, that it was excellent and relevant and I appreciate that.
It's fun. It's always fun to work with you, Dori, and love to be able to meet everybody that have asked questions and that are online in person somehow, but it's a great thing that you're doing. And
I think the title is so apt. All of what you've said makes it so clear that how we think about things is very different from some of how we do think about things. So I think making it conscious for ourselves and our clients is so particularly important and helpful. So thank you again, Jan. Thank you all for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio with Dr. Dorian Mintzer. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show, listen to past episodes, or download our free retirement transition guide, visit revolutionizeyourretirementradio.com.